Student Loan Show, episode 48. On today's show, we're going to dive into the unlikely case of somebody sued for a private student loan after it was included in bankruptcy. Stay with us here on the Student Loan Show. Hello again, everybody. This is Jay Fleischman, and welcome back to the Student Loan Show. Thanks so much for taking some time to be with me here today. Today, we've got an interesting question that was submitted to me by a listener, and it deals with a private student loan and a bankruptcy filing. So this is sure to be interesting. Here's the question. I had a private student loan in 2009 and paid it until I filed for bankruptcy in 2013. The private student loan was included in my 2013 bankruptcy, and National Collegiate Student Loan Trust purchased it anyway. They kept trying to collect the money from me, even though I told the collectors numerous times that the debt was included in my bankruptcy. I wrote them letters and included my bankruptcy paperwork. I gave the collectors the case number and my bankruptcy lawyer's information. Now, 3 years later, I got a lawsuit against me trying to collect the student loan plus interest and legal fees on top of it. I'm thinking of ignoring the lawsuit papers because my loan was included in my bankruptcy and I don't think that I owe the money, but I don't want to make a mistake. I also want to file a lawsuit against National Collegiate and their lawyers for harassing me. I've already filed a complaint with the Better Business Bureau and sent a letter to the CFPB and my congressman. What else should I be doing? Well, interesting question, because this is something that happens time and time and time again. First, let's be very clear. Your private student loan wasn't wiped out in your 2013 bankruptcy. You see, all debts have to be listed on your bankruptcy papers, and that's the law. All of your debts, all of your assets, all of the things that you own, and all of the people and entities that you owe money to. And in fact, if you don't list a particular debt on your bankruptcy papers, even if it could be wiped out, it might not be wiped out. And depending upon the bankruptcy case, it might not get treated properly. So all of your debts have to be listed and therefore included on your bankruptcy papers. Now, that doesn't mean that it gets wiped out or discharged at the end of the bankruptcy. Student loans, for example, are wiped out only if there is a separate proceeding filed in the bankruptcy court asking the judge to specifically make that student loan dischargeable. And that's called an adversary proceeding. There are two tests that the courts use in order to make the determination of whether or not your student loan is dischargeable. The most common one is called the Brunner test, named after a court case called Brunner. And under that test, you've got to prove three things. First, based on your current income and expenses, you cannot maintain a minimal standard of living for yourself and your dependents if you're forced to repay the loans. Second, your current financial situation is likely to continue for a significant part of the repayment period. And three, you have made a good faith effort to repay your student loans before filing this adversary proceeding. So that's the Brunner test. It's very widely used, though it's not applied consistently from court to court. A second and lesser utilized standard is called the totality of the circumstances test. And in that situation, the court's going to look at all relevant factors in your case to determine if it's an undue hardship for you to repay your student loans. And though it's difficult to meet the burden under either of these tests, it's not impossible. And many people do get their student loans discharged in bankruptcy, contrary to what you may read about online or hear in the news. Now, again, the adversary proceeding is the name of the case that is filed in the bankruptcy court. And that's a lawsuit that's filed in bankruptcy court against the current lender. And it runs next to your underlying bankruptcy case. Now, the adversary proceeding can be filed while your bankruptcy case is going on, or you can even go back to bankruptcy court later, years later if you need to, and you can reopen your bankruptcy case for the limited purpose of filing that adversary proceeding. So if you reopen your bankruptcy case, it doesn't mean that suddenly you owe all of the money that you used to owe and that got wiped out. It's just reopening for administrative purposes because you can't file an adversary proceeding without an underlying bankruptcy case to go along with it. So the discharge at the end of the bankruptcy is still in place. It's just that the case is open, which is just like opening up a file folder. Same idea. So unless there was an adversary proceeding that was filed and a separate judicial determination that that private student loan was discharged, it wasn't. So the loan was not wiped out in the bankruptcy. So the fact that it wasn't wiped out in your bankruptcy is why they kept trying to contact you. During your bankruptcy case, your creditors and collectors, student loans as well as otherwise, aren't allowed to try to collect from you. It's called the automatic stay, and it gives you a reprieve from the time that you file your bankruptcy case until the time that the case is over. No creditors or collectors can try to collect from you at all. Now, once the case is over, though, the automatic stay is gone, and collections can resume on any debts that weren't wiped out in the bankruptcy case. So if you sent a cease and desist letter, then the collector can't continue to contact you, but the creditor can choose to file a lawsuit against you to collect the debt, and that's what it sounds like happened right here. In the absence of a cease and desist letter, the collector is going to continue to try to do their job and try to collect from you. So that's why they kept trying to contact you. I suspect that you didn't write a formal cease and desist letter, but merely you answered the phone and said, hey, the loan was wiped out in bankruptcy. Here's my information, buzz off. That's not going to be enough in most cases to function as a cease and desist letter. So there's those contacts. That's why they were doing it. Now, you mentioned that you wrote letters and you wrote letters to the CFPB, to your congressman, and you've filed a complaint with the Better Business Bureau. And that's wonderful. Writing letters makes you feel better, and it creates something for the government to work with in the event that there's a widespread investigation of a company or of a sector of the economy, but it doesn't really accomplish anything. First of all, members of Congress do not investigate companies. They make laws. That's a completely different job description. If something particularly bizarre is going on that's never happened before, and a member of Congress happens to have an interest in that particular issue, then maybe they'll see it as a publicity opportunity, but nothing more. Maybe they'll make a speech about it. Maybe they'll talk about it when they're talking about something else. If they've got legislation pending and they want to highlight some of the issues, maybe they'll bring up the information in your letter, but members of Congress aren't going to investigate the debt collector or National Collegiate Student Loan Trust. Now, the CFPB, they are a federal watchdog, and they do have a complaint process, but it functions as a conduit only. They send the complaint that you get over to the company, and then when they get a response back from the company, they forward that back to you. Your complaint then goes into a database, and that database is publicly searchable. Of course, your private and personal information is taken out. So your name, your address, your social security number, account numbers, things like that. But the database is publicly available. And complaints help the CFPB with their work to supervise companies, enforce federal consumer financial laws, and write better rules and regulations. They also report to Congress about the complaints that they receive. And again, they use that in compiling and publishing consumer complaint data, but they're not going to take individual action. Your complaint is going to go to the CFPB and they'll make sure that it gets routed the right way, but really nothing above that. And that's kind of similar to the way that the Better Business Bureau operates. The Better Business Bureau does handle disputes, but those disputes have to relate to marketplace issues experienced with the service or products that a business provides. So in other words, if you buy a pair of shoes and they fall apart, okay, well, that's an issue and a dispute that's related to the marketplace. If you go into a dentist's office and they don't do the teeth cleaning that they're supposed to do, well, then that's a dispute about the services that that business, that professional provides, and the Better Business Bureau is going to get involved in it. But they don't get involved in anything that has nothing to do with the marketplace. So in other words, a debt collector contacting you, the Better Business Bureau isn't going to get involved in that. If there is a marketplace issue, you send your complaint into the Better Business Bureau. They forward it to the business at issue within 2 business days. The business is going to be asked to respond within 14 days. If a response is not received, a second request is made and you'll be notified of the business's response or if they don't receive a response. And the complaints are usually closed by the Better Business Bureau within 30 business days. In other words, the Better Business Bureau is like the kid that gets their lunch money stolen every day in school. You file your complaint, they forward it to the business, they ask them to respond. If they don't, they ask them again. But if the business doesn't respond, then the Better Business Bureau's got no teeth. They've got no laws or regulations. They're not a court or an arbitrator or a tribunal of any sort. They've got nothing to say and nothing to do. All they can do is ask, and if the business doesn't want to respond, then the business doesn't have to respond. So that's why writing letters isn't really going to do anything for you. So the bottom line is that unless there's been an adversary proceeding and a finding in your favor by the bankruptcy court, you still owe the private student loan. Just because it was listed doesn't mean that it was discharged. And if there's no adversary proceeding and no finding of dischargeability, it wasn't discharged. So you still owe the debt. And ignoring the lawsuit is a bad idea. Because if you don't respond to the lawsuit, you're going to face a default judgment. That's a bad thing. So you've got to respond to the lawsuit. That response can take a variety of forms, but the most common one is called an answer. They serve a complaint, you serve and file an answer. And the answer is a legal document that's filed with the court and served on the other side. If they have a lawyer, by the way, you have to serve the lawyer and you're not allowed to contact the company directly. So the answer does a couple of things. It admits or denies the statements in the complaint. So there's an allegation that you borrowed money, either you did or you didn't. It says that you didn't pay, either you did or you didn't, things like that. The answer beyond the admitting or denying the statements in complaint is also going to set out your defenses. Now, that doesn't include, I can't pay. I can't pay is an excuse. And excuses are not defenses. There have to be legal defenses that are set out. And there are a number of them. And based upon where you are, what state you're in, different defenses may come into play. So you want to be able to take a look at that and make sure that you've covered all of your bases, because defenses are very much a use it or lose it sort of thing. If you've got a defense and you don't bring it up in your answer, you may not be able to bring it up later on. So those are your defenses. Beyond that, your answer may include any legally relevant reasons that you didn't make the payment if in fact you didn't, and those are called affirmative defenses. Now, essentially, that's an admission of non-payment with a really good reason. Now, again, that doesn't include I can't pay. It's got to be a legally relevant reason. For example, if you did in fact file an adversary proceeding and get a judicial determination that the student loan was dischargeable in your bankruptcy, that would be a proper affirmative defense. No, I didn't make a payment because the debt was discharged in my bankruptcy. So affirmative defenses are also going to be included in your answer. And the fourth thing that your answer may include, it may include any related claims that you have against the creditor. Now, those are called counterclaims. And again, there are a number of them. You want to make sure that you've covered all of your bases because, again, if you don't bring up the counterclaim now, you may not be able to do so in the future. Instead of filing an answer, you may be able to file a motion to dismiss, or in some places like California, that's called a demurrer, which stands in place of an answer. Most people don't do that in the context of a student loan lawsuit just because they want to be able to get the information from the lender to be able to ascertain whether or not they do owe the money. It seems that it's kind of a waste of your time and energy to file a motion to dismiss or a demur if you actually owe the money and you're going to have to pay it eventually anyway. You might as well just cut right to the chase, get the information that you need so that you can make the decision that is going to be the best for you financially for the long term. One thing that's important to recognize is that you only get a certain amount of time to file an answer. Different states have different rules based upon how you were served. And by the way, service does not mean law and order. It doesn't mean service the way that you see it on TV. It's not you're walking down the street, somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, are you Joe Smith?" You say, "Yeah." And they say, "Here's your papers. You've been served." Service can be done in a variety of different ways. And I always tell my clients that if you get court papers, presume that service is good. Presume that that is service. You don't want to get smart on the entire system and say, well, they didn't do it in exactly the right way, because if they did and you didn't file an answer, you didn't file any responsive papers at all, just because you thought that they just didn't do it the right way, well, you're going to have an uphill battle. So take the action and file the responsive papers. You may decide, or your lawyer may decide, that the way that they served you was improper, and then maybe that's going to be an affirmative defense or a counterclaim in the context of your response. But you've got to respond. And as I said, you don't get forever to file a response. Different states have different rules. In California, for example, you have 30 days after the date that you're served to file a response with the court. And the 30 days includes weekends, includes court holidays, includes weekdays. The only time that you may get an extra day is if the last day falls on a day that the court's closed, in which case you get until the next day that the court's open. So in other words, if your 30 days expires on a Saturday, then you get until Monday. If you were served by any means that did not involve a process server putting the court papers into your hand, that's called substituted service, and then you get 40 days from the date that the papers were mailed to you to file your response. Because if you're served by substituted service, in other words, they give it to somebody else in the house, they've got to mail another copy to you, and you get 40 days from the date of mailing to file your response. So that's California 30 and 40. In New York, it's a little bit different. If you were given the court papers in hand in New York, then your response must be filed and served within 20 days of the date on which the process server files the affidavit of service. The affidavit of service indicates when and where and how you were served. So if you're served in person on a Monday, the process server may not actually file the affidavit of service until Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, sometimes even weeks later. And that date, the date that they file the affidavit of service, that's when your 20 days begins. I tell my clients, presume that they filed the affidavit of service the day that they gave you the papers. Better safe than sorry. unless you're going to go down to the court and you're going to check out the date and you're going to watch it. But it's a lot easier to just presume that they filed the affidavit of service on the day that they gave it to you in hand. Now, if you were served in any other way, again, that substituted service, then you get 30 days to respond from the date of substitute service. So California is 30-40 and New York is 20-30. Every state has their own rules. Again, don't think that this is law and order. Don't think that you know better than the process server or the other lawyers or the court system. If you get papers, presume that they were done the right way and count your days starting immediately. This is not the time to wait till the last minute because the process of putting your responsive papers together can take some time, whether you're doing it on your own, in which case you're going to have to learn a whole new process. You're going to have to learn a lot of stuff in order to make this an effective response. Or if you're hiring a lawyer, that lawyer is going to need some time to take the proper steps to protect your rights. So don't wait until the last minute. If you ignore the court action, that's not going to make it go away. Failure to respond in the time permitted by law gives the creditor the ability to get a default judgment against you. A default judgment is a binding judgment in favor of the creditor. The private student loan company, they're making a claim of whatever amount of money against you. If you don't file a response in time and they get that default judgment against you, you lose. You don't have the right to fight anymore. It is game over. So failure to respond in the time permitted by law gives the private student loan folks the ability to get a default judgment against you. They win, you lose. And in fact, somewhere in the neighborhood of 95% of collection cases of all sorts, private student loans, credit cards, medical bills, personal loans, go to default. That means that people get served with lawsuit papers and 95% of them do absolutely nothing. And those lawsuits get turned into judgments before they realize it. And once the creditor gets a default judgment, it can start to execute on it because until such time that there is a judgment against you, all collection efforts are voluntary. They ask you for money, you say yes or no. You make a decision, they make a decision. It's all completely voluntary. But once they get a judgment against you, you don't have to agree to pay them anything. They can go ahead and take that action whether you like it or not. Depending upon where you live, depending upon your state law, they may be able to garnish you a portion of your wages, take a portion of your money directly out of your paycheck. They may be able to levy your car. In other words, call the tow truck and pick it up and tow it away and sell the car and use the proceeds to pay themselves back. They may be able to put a lien on any real estate that you own. They may be able to levy your bank account, go into your bank account, freeze it, take the money out, and use that money to pay back that judgment. And if you live in a community property state like California, they may be able to garnish a portion of your spouse's wages, even though your spouse isn't legally obligated to pay that debt. Your spouse's wages may be considered community property. That's yours, mine, and ours. So if it is considered community property, then the creditor can execute against that community property, can garnish your spouse's wages, take a portion of their wages for a debt that isn't even theirs, and use that to pay themselves back. So here's my bottom line best advice. First, you've got to take the lawsuit seriously. Realize that this student loan was not wiped out in your bankruptcy. And even if it was, that's an issue that you're going to have to bring up in the context of defending the lawsuit. But you still have to file an answer. Don't just let it go to default because once you let it go to default, You lose, they win, and you can't argue about it anymore. So take that lawsuit very seriously. Pay attention to the date that you got those lawsuit papers, because that's going to start your clock. Take that lawsuit very seriously. If you don't, bad stuff's going to happen. You also want to talk to a lawyer about this. Even if you decide that you're going to go it alone, you're going to defend yourself in court, you don't want to spend the money for full representation, you're going to go it alone. That's fine, but you want to talk to an attorney and get your situation analyzed. A lot of what I do is talk to people who are ultimately going to represent themselves, and I help them analyze their situations. It's worth it to spend a little bit of money to talk to a lawyer and get your situation analyzed, even if you're going to go it alone, or even if you're not going to do anything whatsoever. Because there are some people who are, the term is judgment proof, but I prefer to call it collection proof, because nobody's judgment proof. You can put a judgment against anybody. It all depends upon what you're going to get out of it. And there are some people who are genuinely collection proof. They have nothing that can be taken. They have no wages. They have no car. They don't own any real estate. They're not married, so there's no community property issues in a state like California. They've got nothing to worry about. There's nothing that can be taken from them. But those people need to know. And if you're in that situation, wouldn't you like to know if you are in fact collection proof? Because if you're collection proof, then you don't care if they sue you, or maybe you do for other reasons. Maybe you're trying to protect your credit rating or your credit score. Maybe those are issues that you need to take a good hard look at. But that's the sort of thing that you're only going to know once you talk to a lawyer. And your local court may have a pro bono self-help clinic where you can sit down and talk to an attorney. You may make a decision that you want to talk to a private attorney and spend a couple of bucks on a complete analysis and a rundown of your situation and what your options are. But whatever it is, you want to make sure that you're talking to a professional so that you can make the right decision based upon where you are. You don't want to be in a position where you've made a decision to either do nothing or to file a responsive pleading on your own, and you muck it up because you've missed something, and maybe you've missed something really easy and simple and straightforward. You don't want to be in the position of having missed the boat on something that you didn't have to miss the boat on. So that's my best advice. And that is what you do if you are sued on a private student loan debt, even after you file for bankruptcy. My name is Jay Fleischman. You've been listening to The Student Loan Show. This has been episode 48, and you can find the show notes as well as some links to some other resources. Head on over to studentloanshow.com/SLS048. While you're there, I really think that it would be a great idea if you joined our free Facebook group. That's really where all the action is. I spend a lot of time there answering questions, helping people out. So you can find a link to that also in the show notes. There's also a big button on the side of the show notes page that says join my free Facebook group. It is a closed community. It's only for listeners of the Student Loan Show. But if you go ahead and request entry, I will be sure to approve you straight away. Until next time, remember, always look both ways before crossing the street.